US rule in occupied Earth, or everything you needed to know about genocide but never knew to ask. Part 4. You are next. In part 3, I tried to outline a conceptualization of genocide, which I think was the basis from which Lemkin was thinking. I'm not going to try and reproduce that here or summarize it. But I would just like to point out that we shouldn't try to reduce genocide down to a singular, overdetermined cause. It is the result of many individuals acting through many motivations. And thus, the way I was talking about it was to talk about genocide not being set off by a simple cause such as racism, but rather being about the multiplicity of causes, the totality of causation, and it is aimed at the totality of the being of the target group, of the victim group. Lemkin defined genocide as being a form of warfare, but instead of it being military warfare, quote, against sovereigns and armies, end quote, it was war against, quote, subjects and civilians, end quote. We do not need to distinguish between the sort of internal war against a minority within a state or the sort of war that is waged against a foreign people. So, for example, the Japanese Three Alls campaign, or Three Alls policy, rather, of kill all, burn all, loot all, which they implemented in occupied China, was genocidal because it was aimed at the Chinese people and was not a truly military scorched earth policy. Lemkin focused originally on occupied Europe, but he saw the same processes in the conquest of the Americas, and he spent much more time studying and writing about genocide in the Americas than about Germany's genocides in Europe. He characterized Indian reservations as being a form of concentration camp and symptomatic of genocide. As you can imagine, this sort of thing did not go down well in the 1950s USA. He was unable to find publishers for his later works. As John Docker has said, quote, "We can only mourn that Lemkin's manuscript writings were not published as he hoped, for in them the inherent and constitutive relationship between genocide and settler colonialism is strongly argued, given subtle, intricate methodological form and brought descriptively to life," end quote. In fact, Lemkin died poor and comparatively obscure in 1959. Only 6 people attended his funeral. Had he lived longer, I feel that he would have recognized that things like the Strategic Hamlet Program and the Agraville Program in Vietnam were also symptomatic of genocide, and I'm sure he would have made the leap that links genocide to all forms of imperialism and not merely settler colonialism. Now, I say that because we see exactly the same techniques, exactly what he was talking about, applied in neo-colonial circumstances, but also we could go back and look at the war in the Philippines, and we see that, and that was not a settler colonial process. It wasn't. We saw exactly the same things happening, the same genocide happening, but it wasn't to colonize, it was to dominate. Now, whether related to settler colonialism or not, genocide reveals itself best during military occupations, because they allow a full panoply of genocidal behavior to manifest. Lemkin saw genocide as a combination of ancient and modern practices. On one occasion, it might be the visceral slaughter of a massacre, and on another, it might be the dispassionate exercise of issuing papers that reclassify people as no longer having the right to live in their homes. One might reduce the food intake available to people who've previously been deprived of subsistence resources, or create a policy of retaliatory violence. One might order the carpet bombing of an area, or institute a military doctrine of force protection guaranteed to cause mass civilian death and widespread terror. In short, genocide can manifest as wanton violence and destruction, or targeted violence and destruction. It can involve policies designed to control, to destroy, to immiserate, to alienate, or to provoke. Perpetrators of genocides like to claim that their actions are military in intent. Sometimes they are deliberately deceiving, and sometimes they are willfully lying to themselves. The greatest lie they will tell themselves and others is that attacking the civilian population and its infrastructure is a valid way of degrading military strength. This is the lie that was behind the so-called strategic bombing of civilian areas in World War II and was used to implement the genocidal sanctions against Iraq. These are very instructive examples of genocide undertaken in the guise of warfare, or in the guise of state versus state diplomacy in some senses in case of the sanctions. But instead of looking at instances like these, I want to focus instead on counterinsurgency. Now, imagine for a minute a materially or numerically inferior people who occupy land that you covet. So you are the hegemonic power, right? You start taking their land from them by force and/or start using your superiority to coerce their departure through inflicting some form of pain or deprivation. Eventually, resistance will ensue. The resistance may or may not have been part of your plan in the first place, but it now becomes an excuse for ever greater violence against the people as such. War against a people as such is by definition genocide. And when you deconstruct counterinsurgency programs throughout history, you will find that this pattern of genocide is common to many of them. I already mentioned the Japanese Three Alls campaign. The excuse for this genocidal behaviour was that it was a way of combating the People's Liberation Army, which drew sustenance from the people themselves. Mao said, quote, "The guerrilla must move amongst the people as a fish swims in the sea," end quote. But the point is that the people wouldn't have supported the PLA if it did not in some way embody their collective will. The Japanese, by contrast, were inimical to the Chinese people. They were their inherent enemies. Their occupation was already genocidal. If they hadn't been strategically inclined to inflict destruction of the Chinese people as such, they would have dealt with the insurgency, more than insurgency, it was a war really, the war for independence, the communist uprising, or the communist resistance, by actions, policing or military, that were restricted to the PLA itself. In fact, the genocidal strategic imperative was greater for the Japanese than the military strategic imperative, because the counterinsurgency strategy, the so-called counterinsurgency strategy they used, is in fact inherently counterproductive in military terms. To put it in simple terms, you win a counterinsurgency by winning the hearts and minds of the people, and thus isolating the guerrillas from the material support of the people and delegitimizing the guerrillas so that violence against them does not cause people to hate you. But if your strategic designs are against the fundamental welfare of the people themselves, you cannot win their hearts and minds. And so it is inevitable that when armed resistance arises, the response, if you do not alter your strategic aims, will become genocidal. It's no great secret that the way to win against an insurgency is to win the acceptance of the people and then to treat the guerrillas as a separate military or policing operation. The reason that this is not done is not that people don't know it, but because they cannot accommodate the will of the people even to the degree that would allow them to cease supporting the conflict of armed resistance. And if you think about that, people want peace. They don't want conflict going on around them. But you're talking about an imperial power that won't even allow them enough security and comfort of subsistence or economic independence that they will abandon support for ongoing conflict around them. It's not a very high bar. But to put it in brief terms, for demostrategic reasons, the people, the imperial power, are enemies of the people, and they are at war with the people. It doesn't matter if this is a tribe of 300 or a nation of millions, the same applies. Now, just as the genocidal acts of the Japanese drove people into the arms of the PLA, the same pattern has been enacted throughout Latin America, Southeast Asia, and in Eastern Europe during the Partisan War against Germany. In fact, Hitler said, quote, "This partisan war has its advantages as well. It gives us the opportunity to stamp out everything that stands against us." Now, it is well worth remembering at this point that Lemkin described Hitler's genocides as being, quote, "a new technique of occupation aimed at winning the peace even though the war itself is lost," end quote. Since the First Indochina War, the US has shown unmistakable signs that it welcomes and even fosters insurgent resistance as a way to channel its military might into genocidal violence and destruction. Now, I should explain that the First Indochina War was, of course, a war of independence against France by the peoples of Indochina, but it became the US effectively took over the war from France using French soldiers, but they funded it and directed it, basically. So even in the First Indochina War, they were doing this sort of thing. Now, few people realize how much of the US effort in Indochina went into systematically attacking civilians without even the pretext of a nominal insurgent presence. They did this on the basis that the people themselves were the sea in which the guerrillas swam, you know, as according to Mao's dictum. The entire Phoenix program, for example, was aimed at civilians. Free fire zones were, among other things, designed to redesignate non-combatants as legitimate targets for death. Under this logic, missions of mass death could be carried out without any hint of an actual combatant might be present. US personnel were also trained to view the people of Vietnam through a hostile racial lens. That, and the way GIs were deployed, created a systematic situational predisposition for US personnel to view the people of Vietnam to be their enemies, or the enemy. If the US had wanted to, a fraction of the money it had spent on fighting in Indochina could have been spent in ways that won the hearts and minds of the South Vietnamese people. But that would have actually empowered those people to a certain extent. The Vietnamese would have been very thankful for this wealth and this democracy, assuming they gave them democracy, and would then have firmly continued to move towards reunifying their country and exercising self-determination. The US now exerts more hegemony over Vietnam by having visited genocidal destruction and lost the military struggle than it could ever have done by making the concessions needed to allow it to achieve military victory. The state of Vietnam was actually far less damaged by US destruction than the people of Vietnam. The war left the country as a military powerhouse and a regional hegemon. On the other hand, bottom-up development was crushed, and when industrialization took hold, it was not some form of strategic development that empowered the proletariat as was originally envisaged, and the nation. It was low-wage, light manufacturing for the benefit of Western multinationals and Western consumers. That is a profound strategic victory for the US empire. And that's not even counting the fact that Vietnam is under the Washington Consensus and beholden to, through debt, to the financial institutions of the IMF and the World Bank and so forth, and all the Western capital centres in London and New York, you know, which makes it basically a neo-colony, really. Now, Vietnam's ongoing weakness means that it is subject to the governance of this Washington Consensus and their institutions, and they use debt and trade to prevent development, which becomes a form of structural violence. But at least for Vietnam, there seems to be little prospect of hostile military action from the US. Iraq, on the other hand, seems to be slated for an internal, grinding, inhuman violence punctuated by periods of mass slaughter. Iraq has become like Prometheus to the US Zeus. Zeus ordered his servants force and violence to chain Prometheus to a rock where each night an eagle would tear out his liver. This was partly in revenge for Prometheus tricking Zeus out of what Zeus thought he deserved to be given as offerings by humans, and partly because Prometheus, who was a friend to humanity, had given fire to the humans. In many respects, the analogy is chillingly apt. For the US, even backing successful coups in Iraq didn't produce regimes that were willing to make sure that Iraqi oil wealth was used to benefit US hegemony. Thus, Iraq cheated the US out of what it considers its due. Due to a combination of petroleum, geography, demography, culture, and history, the Iraqi people, as such, are indelible enemies of the US empire. Even under Saddam Hussein, oil resources were nationalized and oil profits went into national development. Iraq is too large to be a rich rentier state with a small wealthy citizenry, like one of the smaller Gulf states, and is too small for the oil profits to be inaccessible by the bulk of the population, as in Nigeria. And this is a very big problem for an imperial polity, the US empire, that specifically uses the control of petroleum as a method of strategic hegemony. And that's global strategic hegemony, so it needs to exert control over it globally. The result is that if you want to see an almost exhaustive exemplar of genocide, then you should look at what the US has done in Iraq. It has been, to paraphrase Lemkin, quote, a coordinated plan of different actions aimed at the destruction of essential foundations of life of Iraqis with the aim of annihilating Iraq itself. The objectives of the plan are the disintegration of the political and social institutions of culture, language, national feelings, religion, and the economic existence of the national group, and the destruction of personal security, liberty, health, dignity, and even the lives of the individuals belonging to such groups, belonging to Iraq or who are Iraqis. End quote. Now, to outline the Iraq genocide, I can go through each one of Lemkin's so-called techniques of genocide. He enumerated these in Chapter 9 of Axis Rule in Occupied Europe, which, as you will recall, is where the term genocide originates. His descriptions of the techniques of genocide can be very closely mapped to US actions in Iraq. And remember that this is the original defining document on what genocide actually is, and you can go through it point by point and see how well it applies to US actions. The process is far too complex to detail fully here, but I can give you a rough outline, and hopefully you can use your own faculties and prior knowledge to fill in some gaps. So, one, the first technique of genocide was labelled political. And this would include the de-Ba'athification process, the period of rule by Paul Bremer, which was ruled by Dictat, whatever, The suppression of mass demonstrations, of political dissent and of organised labour, the subversion of sovereignty and the imposition of constitutional arrangements. Two was social. Here we have the changing of the legal structure, abolishing unionism, targeted killings of community leaders, fomenting sectarian division, disruption of family, social and economic life by targeting military-aged males for disappearance or death. One of the biggest social impacts comes from the eliticidal killings of intellectuals and certain professionals such as doctors. This began with the debathification, and then there were kidnappings, and then the US instituted the so-called Salvador option, and since that time, intellectuals have often been targeted by death squads. Three, cultural. To paraphrase Lemkin, by merely changing the word regimentation to chaos and the word Poland to Iraq, quote, not only have national creative activities in the cultural and artistic field been rendered impossible by chaos, but the population has also been deprived inspiration from existing cultural and artistic values. Thus, especially in Iraq, where national monuments destroyed and libraries, archives, museums, and galleries of art carried away. Let me repeat that. National monuments destroyed and libraries, archives, museums, and galleries of art carried away. It's almost like they modelled the occupation on what happened in Poland. Now, I should say here that I'm not saying that Iraq's national creative activities have been rendered impossible, but I mean there was certainly a point there where it was akin to that. Number four is economic, and I'll quote Lemkin again, quote, the destruction of the foundations of the economic existence of a national group necessarily brings about the crippling of its development, even a retrogression. The lowering of the standards of living creates difficulties in fulfilling cultural spiritual requirements. Furthermore, a daily fight literally for bread and for physical survival may handicap thinking in both general and national terms. In 2013, Iraq passed the $100 billion mark for post-invasion oil sales. And yet somehow Iraqis still languish mired in poverty. Five, biological. In this category, Lemkin discussed measures that Germans used to lower birth rates, particularly by geographically separating men and women. The US has pursued policies which separate men from women en masse, but not to such an extent that would affect the birth rate significantly. Bear in mind, however, that the physical and environmental aspects of the genocide against Iraqis, such as the toxification which is causing horrendous birth defects, they've also acted to reduce birth rates and may be even more cruel in some ways than dividing families. Six is physical, and Lemkin divided this into three subcategories. A. Discrimination in feeding. By 1998, it was calculated that 1 million had died because of sanctions imposed on Iraq. In infants particularly, this was from a combination of disease and malnourishment. The perpetrators, the US and UK, blamed the Iraqi government, but the Iraqi government's rationing system was as efficient and equitable as could reasonably have been expected. In fact, it cannot be denied that in this regard, the Ba'ath government provided far better and far less corrupt service than any large-scale service provided by the US government or any US contractor in Iraq. In reality, the deaths were the result of the deliberate withholding of essential nutrition and medications by the US and the UK. B. Endangering of health. In addition to the sanctions preventing medications from reaching Iraq, they also prevented medical equipment from being replaced. This was a slow, torturous atrocity whose intentionality cannot be questioned, given that it took place over a period of a decade. Then, during the invasion and the occupation, the US military forces systematically targeted medical personnel and medical facilities. This was something that Dar Jamail was at pains to document at the time and compiled into an alarming report in 2005. Not content with merely bombing hospitals and systematically murdering health workers, the occupation authorities also used the same sort of destructive policies they used on economic assets, giving both US and Iraqi money to corrupt contractors who had been formally made immune to both Iraqi and US law and were thus guaranteed impunity in advance. While facilities struggled to cope with mass violence and to rebuild that which had been degraded during the sanctions period, Iraqi funds were misspent on lining the pockets of rich US contractors. C. Mass killing. The shocking results of the mortality survey in 2006, known as Lancet 2 or L2, have now been vindicated. As well as a very high rate of violent death, L2 showed that up to 2006, where known, most people were killed by coalition forces and most people were killed by small arms. That means they were shot with bullets. Total mortality in Iraq due to the invasion is above 1 million. If this is added to the fatalities caused throughout the previous 13 years, the figure is considerably in excess of 2 million. 7. Religious. Here I could cite numerous attacks on and destructions of mosques carried out by coalition forces in the first few years of the occupation. But it is impossible to avoid mention of the sectarian and religious conflicts caused by the occupation. This is portrayed as something that is an endemic problem, but that is a complete lie. Westerners don't seem to grasp how unusually blood-drenched Christianity is and how sickeningly racist it is to project that particular tradition of violent intolerance onto others in order to avoid seeing Western culpability in fomenting these bitter divisions. Just to be clear, though, it is not Christian theology that originated the violence of the religion, but rather the fact that it became the state religion of a thousand-year-old empire, the Roman Empire, that had already established a habit of brutally killing those it considered ideologically heterodox. Indeed, Christians themselves had frequently been victims of this impulse. And then, once Christianity was bedded into Roman politics, it was inevitable that the Roman approach to heresy would reassert itself. Then the church split, and when Rome became the centre of a quasi-sovereign multinational so-called papal monarchy, and this Western church found that its power was greatest when it was fighting heretics and infidels, and it became addicted to bloody crusades, because those were the things that gave it power and relevance. This was not just to the Holy Land, but also the brutal, genocidal Albigensian Crusade. And after that, there was the Inquisition, and then the Reformation set off wars of religion, which killed millions upon millions. That's not to even mention the indelibly Christian flavour of Western imperialist violence, which continues to this day. Now, Buddhism, Hinduism, and Islam all have violence in their past and present, but none have a history that compares to this. For that reason, I get very angry when people talk about sectarian violence in Iraq as being the result of some ancient enmity. Very little of the violence in Islam's history has a sectarian origin. Western historians talk about Shia political participation in the original Sunni-ruled caliphate as being so-called political quietism. But even that is projecting a Western standard coloured by things like the massacre of Huguenots in Paris. I could go on about this, but I hope you get the point. 8. Moral. Lemkin wrote, quote, "In order to weaken the spiritual resistance of the national group, the occupant attempts to create an atmosphere of moral debasement within this group, According to this plan, the mental energy of the group should be concentrated on base instincts and should be diverted from moral and national thinking. It is important for the realization of such a plan that the desire for cheap individual pleasure be substituted for the desire for collective feelings and ideals based upon a higher morality. End quote. Now, I think this is a very subjective area, but I think that the imperial pattern that the US tries to replicate everywhere, including at home, is one of atomized consumerism. In Iraq, this happens to mesh with the social, cultural, and economic destruction that I've mentioned above, making it certainly have the colour of genocide, if nothing else. And finally, number 9, environmental. Now, Lincoln didn't have this category, but it does now seem to be a salient and highly important technique of genocide. Lincoln had no environmental awareness as such because of the times he lived in. But some people now use the term ecocide to refer to the systematic environmental destruction. And I believe that ecocide is best understood as being one of these techniques of genocide. It was very complementary to all the other ones that Lincoln came up with. In Iraq, the US has systematically caused environmental degradation by destroying infrastructure and contaminating areas with toxins, radioactive material, and unexploded anti-personnel ordnance. Perhaps the most well-known pollutant is depleted uranium, but recent studies in Fallujah show that this is only one part of a toxic cocktail that causes birth defects and cancer. Practices like using burn pits have also created deadly exposure to toxins for both Iraqis and US personnel. Like Agent Orange, these are slow-motion chemical weapons attacks. And like gas attacks, there is always some so-called blowback onto your own personnel. After all, for a war leader, sacrificing pawns is necessary to win the game. Like Agent Orange, the pollution will kill for many generations, causing health problems and heart-rending grief. Worse than even Agent Orange, however, some of these pollutants will stay for as long as we can foresee, a legacy of death and suffering that is practically eternal. The Iraq occupation was a watershed moment, but it was not an aberration. It was part of an increasingly genocidal imperial policy that has blossomed into a series of ongoing neo-colonial postmodern holocausts. The US sows conflict and instability and ensures that there is never any conclusion. Through direct or proxy interventions, the US has created one eternal war zone after another. There is now a string of destabilized states, many of them so-called failed states, whose people are denied any path to peace, and the situation is proliferating. Yemen, South Sudan, Libya, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Somalia, Western Pakistan, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. These are acute cases, but there are many other countries that have a lower level of chronic violence and instability. These spreading zones of violence are a new form of genocide that slowly effectuates, quote, the destruction of essential foundations of the life of national groups, end quote. Can it be said that the goal is to annihilate these nations? Yes, it can, because the goal is to annihilate them as such. It is imprinted in the logic of genocide. Because the violence provokes resistance, the logic of genocide will demand unending violence. The violence creates its own strategic imperative for continuation, while at the same time, the institutions created to carry out that violence gain a substance and a life of their own. History will record the current era as a time of neo-colonial slaughter, much like the spasm of imperialist violence at the end of the 19th century, an increasingly mechanized bloodletting that foreshadowed the slaughter of World War I. However, genocide is not a discrete and absolute phenomenon. It is never a case that a genocide is committed in isolation. The current genocides have long historical roots. US counterinsurgency in the Indian Wars in Latin America, in Asia, is cross-pollinated with South Africa's total war against its neighbours, and Indonesia's genocides, and Israel's invasions of Lebanon, and occupation of Palestine. And this has created a system of institutional knowledge rife with various techniques of balkanization and destabilization. By playing hawks off against doves, US imperialists create room for themselves to inflict unending violence without ever allowing the perception of control that a military victory would give. Retired General Mike Flynn believed that the US needed to use more military force to defeat IS, but has also said, quote, "What we have is this continued investment in conflict. The more weapons we give, the more bombs we drop, that just fuels the conflict," end quote. This is a complaint that has gone right back to 1950, becoming particularly prominent during the Second Indochina War. Military officials try to explain that they are hamstrung and prevented from achieving military victory, but rather than taking their claim seriously, they are written off as being overzealous madmen. The fact is that apart from some insane proposals to use nuclear weapons, the military types do have a point. Military decisions are avoided, i.e. military victories, are avoided for the same reason that counterinsurgencies become counterproductive, because the real enemy is the people, and a military victory would only hinder the strategic goal of crushing the people themselves. It would also be wrong and artificial to separate genocidal wars abroad from domestic governance. The institutions of genocide that Germany created when it committed genocide in East Africa are considered important antecedents of the later genocides in Europe. But the first people that the Germans put in concentration camps were German political dissidents. The first Nazi mass killings were of disabled Germans. Military war, genocide, and the quotidian oppression of domestic governance partake from each other. In the US, there is a long interplay between the criminal justice system and the genocidal attacks on people of other countries. This is inseparable from the past genocides of colonization. Ajamu Baraka, writing on the recent death in custody of anti-police brutality activist Sandra Bland, wrote, quote, "The struggle in the US must be placed in the anti-colonial context, or we will find ourselves begging for the colonial state to violate the logic of its existence by pretending that it will end something called police brutality and state killings." So he's basically saying we can't, it's pointless to try and tell the state to stop doing something that is inherent to its own logic if you're not going to change that underlying logic. Mass incarceration, domestic torture, police killings, and mass surveillance are all institutions that feed and feed from genocide abroad. In this sense, you can see that it becomes an impediment to argue that a given phenomenon is a genocide. Instead, we need to acknowledge that a phenomenon such as US mass incarceration is genocidal, not a genocide. Now, a famous quote from Martin Niemöller begins, quote, "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist." And it ends, quote, "When they came for me, there was no one left to speak out," end quote. That is the nature of genocide. If we do not find a way to end the genocidal interventions in the Third World, our turn will come. And collectively, it already has. An elite habituated to meeting obstacles with genocidal violence will enact it on their own people, and that has already begun. If an innocent Caucasian is brutalized by a US policing and mass incarceration system that is primarily aimed at people of color, that does not make that person an aberration of collateral damage, but rather an indication that those institutions will be used against whomever it serves. The divisions between some them and some us are lies. They mean nothing. But we are made to feel that the mass violence perpetrated by our governments on distant foreigners is no threat to us, and may even be to protect us. It is not true. Every death we allow to happen places us all at greater risk, places our loved ones at greater risk. And one day, when it happens where you live, those who might speak for you will be dead or silenced. But speaking out now has to be an act of true revolt. Ours is an age in which there is no more crucial imperative than that of demolishing the lies of elite ideology. Western regimes are almost impervious to the opinion of the masses, so mass education is far less important than deprogramming the apparatchiks that populate our boardrooms, newsrooms, seminar rooms, and lecture theatres. We do not need to educate the masses. What will they do when they are educated? Be knowledgeably powerless? No, we need to enrage the masses and delegitimize the elites. Their intellectual and moral pretensions are hollow, and we need to burst that bubble. To do this, more than anything, we need two things. One is to rediscover the knowledge and analysis of imperial power, and the other is to understand that imperialist violence, including structural violence, is genocidal in nature. Elite Western ideology was struck a blow by the end of the Cold War. By the late 1990s, analysis of globalization had begun to merge with a new and not exclusively Marxist or Marxian interest in US empire. By now, though, this has almost been completely expunged. In its place, we have the traditional dullard stance of those who, without ever having to trouble their brains for confirmation, take it as granted that the default approach of the US is to seek to create stability and spread democracy. Less Pollyanna-ish, but equally blind, are those who view US foreign policy as a variety of so-called realism in response to so-called national security threats, such as so-called Islamist terrorism. But most infuriating of all are the opponents and critics of US foreign policy, who are now dominated by beliefs that US foreign policy is controlled by the Israel lobby and or acts primarily in order to deliver profits to the military-industrial complex. These are not only tropes of repugnant apologism, but they are fatuous, ahistorical, anti-intellectual, conceptual cul-de-sacs which make cogent analysis impossible. They clearly satisfy deep-seated psychological needs to deflect blame, but they mainly fulfill the role of concealing continuities and preventing people from seeing the true shape of US imperial interventions. In contrast, to illustrate the potency of the term genocide, imagine how difficult it would have been for the US to justify its actions in Iraq if academic and media interlocutors had seen the pattern of genocide in US actions. Currently, continuity and intentionality are concealed by simply replacing and recycling varying excuses made to a limitedly amnesiac intelligentsia. No one steps back and asks whether the current excuse for genocidal violence actually makes sense in the larger picture. Saddam might invade his neighbours again, bomb the water infrastructure. Saddam has WMDs, starve the people. There's resistance to our occupation. Dismantle all the economic infrastructure and destroy the historic sites. Insurgency. Kill. ISIS. Bomb. Iraqis don't love us. Bomb some, arm others, then arm the ones you bombed and bomb the ones you armed. If it wasn't all so horrifically serious, it would be a pathetic joke. Understanding the genocidal nature of this violence is the only way to end the cycle of mutating rationalizations. This is a war for ideas. If they can't launch a bombing campaign with a lie about a gas attack, the next lie will come along shortly and eventually one will stick. Take Gaza, for example. Israel's violence has been justified as being, quote, because Hamas, because rockets. But already you can see the beginnings of a new, trendier, more nuanced discourse being established, where it is the failings of Hamas to control the Salafists that will justify future genocidal violence. Because ISIS, because rockets. And when that wears out, there will be another excuse. And if we don't escape the parameters of discourse set by the idea that Israeli actions are related to security, whether you agree with them or not, there will never be an end to potential excuses. While we debate the merits, they will kill more, and so it will continue. To conclude, I hope that Anuradha Mittal learns what I've said here, and I hope she decides that it's not a good idea to give a detailed hour-long account of a genocide and then to balk at using the term genocide itself. What she described was a people who were dispossessed, had their movement controlled, were cut off from the native soil that provided them economic and psychological health, had family lives shattered, were traumatized, were deprived of materials of culture and religion, had social networks destroyed or degraded, and finally had their history, their agency, and ultimately their humanity expunged from the official state narrative of history. If that isn't genocide, then there can be no such thing. I would also like Chris Hedges and Laila El-Aryan to reflect on the fact that they published a book in 2008 that specifically claimed that US personnel were systematically murdering Iraqis in large numbers but never used the word genocide. Perhaps they can see now that they effectively orphaned their work and made it irrelevant by not giving the systematic killing its rightful context as being genocidal mass killing. To put the murders they talk about in any real context that relates to them to the bombing, the sanctions, economic destruction and social disintegration and the civil war absolutely requires that the word and the concept of genocide be used. The word must be used because the genocide continues in Sri Lanka as it does in Iraq. The situation in Iraq is well known, but what Mittal described is also alarming because the Sri Lankan government seems to use weakness to deepen persecution. They seem to have exploited the military weakness of the Tamil Tigers at the end of the civil war to conduct mass murder, and they have used their victory to rewrite history to further denigrate Tamils. That forebodes further armed mass violence. By the appropriate use of the term genocide, however, public alarm and discontent can be wakened. Once people actually grasp the meaning of the word, it will be much easier for groups such as Tamils to awaken people and much harder for perpetrators to convince them to stay asleep. Perhaps most important of all is the potential to cause a revolt of the guards. This is something that Howard Zinn famously advocated at the end of A People's History of the United States, and it is also something that Chris Hedges refers to frequently. The fact is that when people come to understand that they are engaged in a necessarily atrocious and criminal enterprise, they are liable to stop. The concept of genocide can open people's eyes to the cruelty in which they have become enmeshed. But the power of the word does not end there. Many of the war resistors within the US military who acted against the genocide in Indochina used the term genocide to justify their actions or their refusal to act. It is a very powerful position to take, to say, this is genocide, and I will not partake in genocide. If someone says this war is immoral, the counter-argument is that it is not for them to decide what is moral. But if you say this is genocide, then any disputant is inevitably going to have to argue that this is not genocide. And that opens up the discourse to discussions of human suffering as opposed to notions of threats and security and combat that dominate the discourse of war. The fact is that there are clearly people out there who will actually argue that it is sometimes right to commit genocide. In that sense, perhaps spreading a greater understanding and a more widespread usage of the term does risk the so-called debasing the coin. These people will crawl out of the woodwork, and then there will be a discourse of genocide versus genocide light, for example. Various reasons will be put forward that some genocide is tolerable and maybe even necessary, and perhaps even sometimes a moral good. But most people will never buy into that. Genocide necessarily means deliberately inflicting suffering on the innocent. In practice, military warfare also means this, but proponents can always argue that such suffering is an unfortunate side effect of an otherwise perfectly moral enterprise of destruction, killing, and maiming. Now, when something is appropriately labelled and understood as genocide, however, the perpetrators will have no place to hide, and that is what we need.